Netcasting from Chicago, Los Angeles, and Sydney. You're listening to this week's FX Podcast from FXGuide.com.
Thanks for joining us for this FX Podcast. I'm Jeff Huser. Today's podcast is with Stefan Wild of the Jim Henson Company about the PBS show Sid the Science Kid. At SIGGRAPH in Los Angeles this year, we had a chance to do quite a bit of reporting on performance capture and motion capture, and we also visited the folks at Third Floor to see how they were using performance capture for previz. Sid the Science Kid features Henson Studios animating CG characters using real-time performance capture at a very high level for faces and body motion, so I think you'll find this very interesting. Before we get to the podcast, I wanted to mention I've had a lot of people asking about the third podcast in the Labor series. I'd teased this several times. I had done multiple pre-interviews with a guy from the state of California who is a lawyer, so really just wanted to have some more time to do detailed research on our industry before he spoke, which made sense, and we were heading to be able to record. But as happens a lot when we're doing these podcasts, we chase things down and they fall through. In this case, I've been able to contact the guy for months now. So I'm going to have to start the process over again, find the new source. The topic's not dead. In fact, we've had several emails from people from places like India detailing conditions in post that we'd really like to follow up on. And we think that this is a hugely important area. And in fact, I personally would like to say that there's probably no more important issue facing visual effects than the business side. And we could go on and on about this forever, but keep it, just so you know, it's on our minds. We're going to do more on the Labor series, on the business of visual effects. It's very much a high priority here at FX Guide to do more like that and to share information as much as possible in these, especially in these tougher economic times. But anyway, let's get on into this week's podcast. Let's join Mike Seymour with Stefan Wild.
Thanks. Well, Jim Henson Productions, or the Jim Henson Creature Shop, is behind this new series that debuted on PBS called Sid the Science Kid. It's a morning program aimed at aspiring, you know, kids who are interested in science. And behind it is some really amazing technology, a very complicated system of mocap, digital puppetry, and virtual photography, all in real time, that allows them to produce each episode as if it's a live-action sitcom. They use motion analysis, Final Cut, Maya, and some proprietary tools to pull it all together. Now, some of you may remember that Henson himself, Jim Henson himself, actually started doing something like this way back in the 80s. So this is a long path for these guys. And they've been really successful at working with the latest cutting edge technology to see if they can incorporate a digital pipeline into puppetry. We're going to talk to one of the producers, Brett Nelson, in a moment. But before then, I started off by talking to Stefan Wild. Now, Stefan is actually German in background. He moved over to the USA but has a long history in commercials and in feature films. He was working in Europe for about 10 years before he moved to Hollywood. And in 95, he worked on Independence Day, for example, and has worked at places like CFC and Pacific Ocean Post. He was actually at Centropolis, who worked on Godzilla, and he was actually responsible for developing the facility's production pipeline as well as the digital pipeline for the, you know, computer-generated Godzilla effects. In 2007, he joined the Jim Henson Company as the studio's digital supervisor to help, you know, build out their, and I guess streamline their digital pipeline for digital puppetry. He's currently the digital supervisor day-to-day on Sid the Science Kid, and I asked him about the show and its target audience.
Sid the Science Kid is a preschool show, age group 3 to 6, and it's about science readiness for children.
I'm looking for my friends. I'm looking for you. There's Gabriella.
Watch what I can do.
So the way it came about actually is like twofold. On the creative side, looking actually how we can utilize animation to support education, basically in the long-standing Henson tradition of earlier shows like Sesame Street, The Muppets, where there's always like an educational aspect to it. And now seeing where we are right now, now, can we come up with a concept that actually nurtures children growing up, that actually helps children or encourages children asking questions, and then especially in today's day and age, can we actually come up with a concept that helps children ask scientific questions and also solve scientific problems on their own without having to wait for an adult or teacher telling them an answer up front, but actually finding something out, encouraging them to be active, to get active, to get involved in kind of creative thinking, problem solving.
We're taking the disciplines of more than 50 years of the Jim Henson Company, puppeteers, suit performers, puppet fabricators, and electronic geniuses all working in concert to deliver a singular vision here in real time.
And that was the voice of Brett Nelson, the producer of Sid the Science Kid. So I asked Stefan about this history that Henson has, leading back to, I can certainly remember when Jim Henson himself tried to see if it was possible in the earliest days of computer graphics to at least give some kind of feedback to a puppeteer to allow them to do digital puppeteering, and then later, of course, go back and do high-quality rendering. Back then, even giving any kind of real-time performance of 3D animation in the most crudest forms was incredibly difficult.
Yeah, no, absolutely. So this was actually in the late 80s, really it goes back that far, where Jim Henson, when he was still alive, already conceptualized what it would take to perform a character in the computer. And it did very early tests, kind of again stretching technology at that time to the limit, and created a character that's called Waldo. And actually, it's like, it's so funny because Waldo still exists and can actually be seen in the Muppet 3D Theater, which I think is still up in, I think, Epcot Center in Disneyland. Because back then, you only were able to perform like a wireframe mesh. So you, as a puppeteer or as an audience, you wouldn't really be looking at a finished-looking image in real time. It would just be this see-through model, and you would have to envision what it will look, and you had to go through a post-process render to get to a finished result, which took, of course, like a zillion of hours back then. And now with today's graphics cards, today's computing power, and we actually created our own cluster computing system for that. I think right now, let me just do the math, over 30 cores are rendering all together on this environment, each being tasked with like different aspects of the scene file, rendering a character, rendering an environment piece, and then getting everything back together in one coherent image at the end of the day, so that this technology now allows us actually to, in a way, fulfill a vision that Jim Henson set out now over 20 years ago.
And that was Stefan Wild. Of course, one of the things about puppetry is its live-action properties. The fact is that you have a real performance. You have people standing there doing it. And even with major computer-animated films today where we have motion capture, it's normally just a rough representation of what's going on that is seen on the day by the director. What Henson's have done, which is really interesting, is always push to get an interactive performance that's far more like the original puppeting experiences, as Brett Nelson explains.
It allows us to produce animation using live television disciplines. The suit performer has tracking markers, and their body movements drive the character's body performance. The puppeteer uses a set of hand controls to drive all the expressiveness of the character while he's providing the voice at the same time.
I wonder why Grandma's glasses make everything blurry for me, but for her, they make everything clear.
It actually is a very interesting process in that regard also, that it combines a lot of different disciplines. So disciplines that we are used, that we know from traditional CGI production, visual effects production, as well as to a certain degree 2D animation production, as well as live action. And I'd like to start with the live action part first, because it's so unusual for digital production to do it that way, but also in the sense of digital puppetry, makes actually so much sense doing it this way.
What's a big idea with that?
Initially, models are being built, and traditional art department process, we build clay models. Once they are approved, we use a 3D scanning system, mostly like a laser scanning system, to scan those maquettes, put them in the computer, and then just using Maya out of the box, character gets modeled, textured, and rigged. Once that action now happened, then this character gets handed off to stage, and this is the big live action portion, which really you can imagine like a three-camera live action sitcom environment. Which means you have a stage, you have your performers, you have a director, you have camera operators, your floor manager, your script supervisor. So all those live action disciplines exist in that environment. And our technology allows us to perform one character using two puppeteers. And the way this is split up is that one puppeteer uses our animation controls, which have its history going back to performing animatronics, so live puppets in front of a camera, using those same controls, but now performing a digital character. That puppeteer performs the face of the character, the head and head motion, the eye line of the character, but also lends his or her voice to the character, so which is very important. So as they're performing the character, they're also speaking the voice of the character.
Okie doke, let's roll!
Let's roll!
And the second puppeteer is actually inside a motion capture volume, very traditional motion capture volume, using optical motion capture and doing the body performance. Both of those puppeteers are in communication via headset, so they can actually, when they're rehearsing, adjust their performance so that actually it feels like one character, really, and it never feels like falling apart. So there's a body performer and a facial performer. It is really coming together as one character.
Working together, the puppeteer and the suit performer are providing the voice, the face, the performance, the entire character head to toe in a single pass. The camera operator is using a virtual camera controller to drive our CG camera the same way he'd drive a regular studio camera. And we can drive them from multiple angles all in a single pass. Because everybody's seeing the character in real time, you can just focus on your core discipline and how it adds to the TV show.
So the big difference actually to a traditional sitcom is that because it's digital, we can actually do like the camera can go around 360 degrees, whereby it's like if we would do traditional photography, we would be limited to a little bit more than 180 degrees. Of camera movement, but therefore, I mean, it is what it is, so we adjust our lighting situation accordingly, and the cameras can actually go around, and whatever the directors would like to achieve can happen. Now, the interesting portion now is that working according to a live-action paradigm means that we stay on a take level. So let's say it's like we have our five characters playing out a scene in front of the schoolhouse in the playground. So they're climbing up and down the play structure. They're using a swing set, running around, interacting with each other. four cameras are shooting all of that at the same time. And now after, whatever, 2 minutes that the take might be long, the director decides, well, that looks great. I would like to print that in traditional terms. So kind of this goes to dailies, this goes to the rushes. In our case, that means we now deploy a real-time render farm. So all the data that was captured that was already viewed actually on stage while the shooting was going on, we have a small post process where we re-render that data stream at a higher resolution so that each frame only in full HD resolution takes a couple of seconds, like 1.5, 2 seconds a frame, and it gets reprocessed and written out as a image sequence that more or less instantly then goes to our editorial. So what that means is that within usually a couple of hours, if we shoot a take in the morning that gets approved by early afternoon, that entire take, its entire length, all the different cameras, ends up in editorial, and editorial can work with that footage. Now, editorial, they take about like 2 days to cut a 30-minute episode together. That's roughly also the time it takes in our live action environment, our stage environment, to shoot an episode. So we allow 2.5 days of stage production to generate 30 minutes of CGI animation, of digital puppetry. And so editorial is cutting all that together, and in a sense, in a traditional sense, they are making their selects, saying, okay, from this scene intake and camera, I use a specific frame range. From another scene intake and camera, I use another frame range. And so this is now what goes into a more traditional CGI post process. So we actually take that data, and because we're using optical motion capture on stage for the body performance, there's still some high-frequency noise or some details that we would like to have cleaned up. So we will not alter the performance that happened on stage, but although our puppeteers are as precise as they can be in that moment, nevertheless, it is a digital and virtual environment, so still the hand might go through the table. When they're shaking hands, the hands might be intersecting each other, things like that that are happening. And so we go through a technical cleanup process where we actually get, where we modify those kind of egregious mistakes that happened during that stage process. And so our animators then will change those function curves and make adjustments to the animation so that a handoff of a prop or the, basically other examples, as I said, like as I mentioned, shaking hands, patting each other's backs, something like that, comes actually across correctly. And that is then the starting point for a final rendering process. So while all this was going on, our lighting department already then established the look. So we have lighting models for each of our environments. We know what the daylight outside in the playground should look like. We know what the lighting environment should look like at night in the bedroom of our main character, or in the afternoon in the kitchen with the parents. Those are all different setups. And so when the scene gets now touched up and comes out of animation cleanup, then our lighting department takes over, puts the lights in the scene, makes sure that none of the texture or shader attachments that were put together early on per prop or per character, that everything is still maintained, is still there. And then the final rendering happens. But again, as I said earlier, going through the editorial process, we only render, of course, in that stage what was requested by editorial for the final product for the finished episode. So we will not render an entire take. We will only render, let's say, 300 specific frames of a specific scene take or camera that was shot on stage. And then once that is done, when that is approved and goes through the process, again, of like dailies being approved by the director, being approved by our producers, then it goes back into the editorial process. And what we're doing there, we actually use Final Cut for our editorial, and our in-house developers wrote software that makes a tremendous use of Final Cut's XML. And so to understand what was actually happening on the timeline, how things relate to each other, automatically any new render gets dropped in onto the timeline. So there is no manual process or manual relinking necessary from an editor's perspective. They simply click an update button, and then everything that was now rendered and has the final look gets reconnected to their already existing editorial timeline, and so they instantly then see the final picture in front of them. And from that point on, it goes through the regular Foley and sound design and music process before it gets delivered to the broadcasting station.
You were discussing the rendering, you know, when you actually go off to do the rendering. Are there any considerations there in terms of the look, just in terms of stylistically, you know, how it looks, the feeling of the imagery?
Oh, absolutely. So this is something we actually figure out very early on in the process. As I mentioned, we're going through a very traditional art department process by building the characters out of clay. Of course, like, that starts with conceptual drawings, with color and mood scripts to see is like if a character is appealing, if the character will work. The same happens for the environments as well. We actually work with designers out of from the animation with a strong animation background, as well as traditional live action production designers, because since we have this live action stage portion in it, we also want to make sure that, as we would do in live action, what we build as a model in terms of scaling will actually also work for our stage process, because nevertheless there is a human in a motion capture environment that has to interact with those props, and therefore they need to fit a certain size relation, kind of prop to character. And that actually gets explored in that art department process. Now, a good thing there is, too, as the long tradition, again, over 50 years of Henson doing puppeteering in different forms, that looking back at something like Sesame Street, Muppets, Fraggle Rock, and other the many projects the company has done, there is a definite style over the years that evolved in terms of animation, how a Henson character moves.
Watch this.
So that, for example, when you think about how a Muppet, in quotes, walks across frame or walks across a stage, it's basically an up and down movement, and then a movement from right to left or left to right. So distinctively different, of course, than a human or humanoid movement would be, or something that we would see with traditional keyframe animation. So this was, of course, the first of one of the many goals to achieve, to keep that type of specific puppetry look to it. And I mean, the audience will be the judge of that if we achieved it, but this is something in terms of the way we designed the system, the way we designed the digital puppetry studio to actually maintain that type of look. The same applies for the surface shaders on the characters, to actually to the most degree possible at this stage, because everything is rendered initially in real time, we want to keep the feeling of some kind of a feltiness of texture on the skin, on the hands of the characters, and some level of a, it's an abstraction to our real world, kind of the way we would build like a puppet house, for example, to bring that into that digital environment. Now, there are some restrictions, and we're constantly, of course, like pushing that envelope forward as well because of production timelines with 40 episodes. We actually have to create 20 hours of HD CGI animation for television within a one-year time frame, which is, of course, vastly different than it's like, I mean, I come from a feature film background. If I would be working on a 3D feature film, and we're already in post-production, so we would have about a year and a half to 2 years with a much, much larger crew to generate about like 70 to 90 minutes of CGI animation. So,
let me just ask you about that for a second, because with your background in doing features, do you think that a different version of this, like let's say you were doing, you know, obviously Henson's has been involved in everything from Yoda to Labyrinth. If you're doing a feature film, do you see this as an applicable thing, you know, to that kind of environment, or what would you have to change to do that?
Well, first of all, the answer is a definite yes. It is applicable for feature film as well. The system would be we would use a slightly modified system because here for this television episode, it's episodic television, we have to keep an eye on high throughput. So we are limiting ourselves to 9 characters in 11 environments. With shaders and textures that allow us to keep render times at a point where we actually can render that tremendous number of footage that we need to have. For feature film, it's applicable because now a digital character can interact with a traditional, or let's say, like can interact with a human much easier because of the type of, and I say type of motion capture environment, because usually what happens when we use motion capture, we're striving for real humanoid or human performance, making it to looking as photoreal as possible. In our case, it's very similar. Again, it's like I bring up the example how a Muppet would interact with a human. First of all, it is very important that there is some feedback or good feedback for the actual actor or actress, how to interact and how to work with the character. But at the same time now, it's like we have the technology to make that interaction happen, but nevertheless, it's like our characters would still be some kind of stylized characters, whether that stylization goes more into the realm of monsters or creatures or cuddly bears. That is kind of the different gamut that is out there. But that would then define what we would be using for our digital puppet. And that actually is very interesting in that regard, going back to the paradigm of motion capture, that we're not simply putting a person or a performer in a traditional motion capture suit with markers and having them pretend to be a certain character or to be a certain type of performer. What we actually do, because of the tradition of puppetry, we augment elements to their bodies that resemble the shape of the actual character. So our characters right now, because they are stylized kid characters, but they have really big heads, really big hands, very big feet. So we build what we call outriggers for them because we have what's called the Jim Henson Creature Shop, which is a group of very, very skilled artists that traditionally build those type of monsters or creatures that actually go in front of real cameras. What they do for us is they build those type of outriggers. So instead of having a person perform or trying to go through a make-believe that I'm heavy, that I have a big belly, we actually would build that big belly for the performer. And if the hands need to be much larger, then we would build those additions for them so that actually they have those big hands, whether that is through big gloves or some kind of, again, animatronic augmentation that needs to happen to make that work. But then we would actually put the motion capture markers on the exterior of that character. And so the performance that we get out of that is a lot different than just having a traditional motion capture performer perform to something that they are not feeling, because I just want to reiterate, it's all about the performance of the character, not about true human or humanoid motion. So always what is right for the character that is being done, and that is how the technology is adjusted and deployed to make that work.
It's me, Sid. This is a roly-poly. He's a tiny little animal. He's so tiny I can't tell if he has legs. I know. A magnifying glass makes little things look much, much bigger. Can you see how he moves?
The great thing is that in this particular case, all this technology is going towards something that has always been close to Henson's heart, which is education and engaging children. And that's just such a terrific thing.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And this was actually something that I have to say is, like, for me personally, was mostly intriguing. That coming from a background where it's like going through feature films like Independence Day, Godzilla, where it's always like visual effects heavy and to a certain degree destructive, where you deal with like explosions. Although it's like your summertime popcorn movies, when you have to scrutinize those images on a daily basis, it's a lot different than moving into character animation, which I did then with like Stuart Little 1 and later on moving on to like The Simpsons. But always that happened in the feature film world where we are under different time constraints and working under different conditions than suddenly taking those paradigms and moving it into the television world, trying to go for high volume, high output, trying to maintain the best image quality possible, but at the same time, in terms of the content, feeling really, really good about it because it has a lot more to offer than being entertaining. It has this additional level of education, of really kind of getting something out there that hopefully kids find engaging, find intriguing, and will actually hopefully it's like get a little bit of a life of its own where our children can relate to those type of characters where they almost become like their friends and mentors for their future.
Well, thank you so much for taking time to talk to us. We really appreciate it.
Oh, I appreciate for having me. It's like it was fantastic talking to you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thanks, Mike. I spent a lot of time as a youth at the Disney theme parks in Orlando in particular, and I certainly remember that character Waldo from The Muppets in 3D, and it's always been a favorite of mine. In fact, I remember a lot of the behind-the-scenes stuff either at the park or on The Wonderful World of Disney showing how that character was created in real time by Henson. So it's really cool to see them honoring that and continuing that work over the years, doing this really advanced stuff now with multiple people performing characters in real time. Very cool story. So that'll do it for this FX podcast. For Mike Seymour in Australia, John Montgomery traveling somewhere in Asia doing master classes. Hopefully he's heading home soon. I'm Jeff Huser in Los Angeles. Thanks for listening.
Please let us know if you have any suggestions for stories or future podcasts. You can reach us by using the Contact Us links at the top of the homepage. This podcast is copyright 2008 FX Guide LLC. Broadcast or redistribution is prohibited without the expressed written consent of FX Guide.